What's up, rock nerds? Welcome back to another Geology Vlog podcast. It's Phil Kerlock coming to you from the Delaware Basin, just outside Jal, New Mexico. And today we have Corey Fair, inventor of Integrity In Situ, a real-time geomechanics and stress measurement tool, coming to us hot from the Canadian foothills of the Rocky Mountains, home of the Calgary Flames from Calgary, Alberta. Welcome, Corey Fair. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in geology, and a little bit about what you do with your company today.
All right, Neil, thanks very much for the introduction. I appreciate the invitation and your time on the podcast. So long story short, I've been in the patch for over 20 years. Started off by literally building core boxes at Core Labs, and that led to working in said Core Labs and getting involved in a lot of different core testing procedures and whatnot. I had a little foray into the IT world for a few years and then got back into the patch. And that led to a lot of project management and some field operations, some lab operations. End of the day, had gone to a technical school here in Calgary known as FATE for my geology training, formal geology training. It's a geology certificate program. I went to night school for this training and went back again for a reservoir engineering course as well. Ended up going to another local university for some project management education. Overall, you know, the geology side of it was particularly rewarding. I had an incredible instructor by the name of, I think it was Kathy Hawks. Anyway, Kathy Young, and Hawk was the name of her consulting firm. Something to that effect. Learned everything from, you know, very basic stuff, but for us it was new and exciting, building fence diagrams and isopack maps all from scratch. And, you know, we had our pencil crayons out and a little bit of arts and crafts involved and learned how to read cement bond logs and apply all this stuff to the stuff I was working on a day-to-day basis, working for a couple different aspects of industry, ranging from coal bed methane to oil sands. At the end of that cycle, as a client in the oil sands, we did a lot of caprock integrity testing for our prospective in situ SAGD property up in northeastern Alberta. With the operations role that I had, I was spending a lot of time with all of our vendors and boots on the ground on the rig, sitting there watching everything happen and making sure that the G&G team was informed and on board with what we were up to. And, you know, call core points here and there, see some core and describe it with geologists, all these different aspects that go into it. As you're well aware, you do that for a living. At the end of the day, the result of having to do this caprock integrity testing was particularly frustrating as a client. The different issues that come along with core capture and going through the lab tests, wait times, very expensive processes, the questions that remain because you're dealing with a disturbed core sample, it led to a lot of uncertainty at the end of the process, which, you know, can be 7, 8, 9 months long. So from a client perspective, it was pretty tough. And being an entrepreneur my entire adult life, this was, you know, literally the fourth or fifth business I'd started or bought into or was involved with in some way. I saw an opportunity to change the process, and having exposure and knowledge of certain downhole systems over the course of my time in the patch, I thought, well, there's certainly tools that can gather this information in situ, but they were all separate systems and they were not all being utilized in the patch. So I kind of came up with this plan to wrap these different functionalities into one instrument and put them into the hole on a piece of string and get these in situ measurements in one run and replace the uncertainty involved with these disturbed cores with the in situ data and see that data in real time versus the wait time associated with taking everything to a lab and, you know, do it on a cost effective basis. So that's essentially where I come from and where we've gotten to now.
What was your motivation, you know, when you were looking forward to getting back into working with oil and rocks? What was your motivation to work with the rock directly? You know, you named your company Integrity In Situ. So based upon what you just told me in pulling the core out, I assume that you think it's better to measure the rock in place in the subsurface rather than, you know, removing what would be rock under stress in the subsurface that then doesn't exist and has to be, you know, calculated or guessed on the surface. So is that something that helped push you in that direction based upon, you know, working with subsurface tools, or was it just, I see a big scatter of science that's being used individually across a broad spectrum and then bringing it together into one tool?
Well, it was a combination of all those things, Neil, but at the end of the day, the fact that the coring process has so many different problems associated with it, ranging from, obviously, core recovery to bringing multiple vendors to the site to tying several different contracts together to making sure you've got the room on the lease for all these different vendors to do their thing. The core recovery is just one of several problems that come along with the overall procedure. And again, you see this all the time, and you know, different rigs have the ability to do this work themselves, but that's not always the case, and it certainly hasn't always been the case in the past. But the main problem is that the data you receive from these labs is based on these cores where the lab is doing their best, and they are very good at it, but they are trying to reproduce an in-situ condition, and nobody would ever argue that it's going to be more accurate than starting with the in-situ condition in the first place. So eliminating the operational problems and inefficiencies that go along with trying to capture the core and have enough of a representative sample that you've got something you can believe in and represent to regulators as well as investors, shareholders, it's a real problem. That was part of the motivation, but the data quality is also something that people have complained about, and regulators are no different. They don't necessarily have the utmost confidence in what comes out of certain processes, so that was sort of part of the challenge as well.
So in using your four-hole geophysics tool, you know, and studying geomechanics, shear stress, failure, you know, that's what I think about, rock stresses, what temperatures are, what does it measure, and then how is the data applied to a oil and gas service provider or a exploration and production company?
Yep, great question. That's the big one, is what does it do and how does the client use it? To be clear, yeah, it's not a geophysical measurement as far as a typical geophysical logging tool would make you think of. This is a direct physical measurement of the rock strength properties and stress conditions via mechanical means that are affecting the wellbore wall. So a common geophysical tool, a sonic scanner, or a gamma, or a density porosity, the list goes on and on. There's a lot of different, very powerful, very useful tools out there, obviously. Those are all applying electrical influence or radiation or sonic waves to the rock, and then by listening or sensing the response of that feedback and the behavior that it then induces, a whole bunch of jiggery-pokery goes on, black magic, a lot of very in-depth calculations go on, a lot of inferences can be drawn from that information. And they're very powerful. They all have their place. I don't think that any one tool is a silver bullet. I think that together you need to put tab A into slot B to form an appropriate puzzle for the questions that need to be answered in any geomechanical problem. So this tool is not looking at an inference based on a reaction. It's physically affecting the rock. So we take something known as a direct shear box test. The lab version of that involves taking a box of a known volume. You cut a core sample down to fit inside that box. You change the dimensions of the core, and you get it in that box. You put a lid on top of the box with a known weight on top of that lid. You pull, now you're applying normal force through that weight. You move the bottom of the box away from that normal box in a perpendicular direction. Now you're applying shear force versus that normal force because, you know, the area you're affecting, force over area gives you stress. We do that test in situ, and we also see the data in real time. And we also have nine. The deep tool that we're working on now will have six, but the shallow prototype has nine contact points. So we're not seeing one point. We're not seeing one axis. We're seeing all the way around the wellbore in a helical design that's contacting physically the wellbore wall. So that's one aspect of our testing. The shear box test has a different purpose with with how we executed on our tool, and that is through running basically a scratch test. So in a lab, you're going to take a blade and run it down the length of the core and get the unconfined compressive strength off that core with the scratch test. And because of the process that we use for the shear head testing, we're doing the same test, essentially, slightly different configuration, but at 6 specific points or 9 specific points. So the shear box test is kind of combined with that unconfined compressive strength scratch test in the shear head component of a tool. The next functionality is something called a mini frac, which everybody's familiar with. They call it a defit. I do not call it a defit because that is a coined phrase from Halliburton, but it is the same thing. It's a low volume, high pressure fluid injection. All of our tests are done open hole because we do need to physically contact the wellbore wall. Because we're testing open hole, we need to inject our fluid in a sealed path to the injection ports on the mini frac system of the tool. And we have a packer above and a packer below those ports, which allows us to isolate the injection zone, just like any other mini frac. So that test is pretty straightforward. We have a couple of intricacies about our system that are quasi-unique, not totally unique, but they do, in theory, help us improve the quality of the data set for that particular test. And the third functionality on the existing tool, the shallow one, which is a prototype, the deep tool that we're building now has a fourth functionality, but I'll get to that. The third functionality on the existing tool is what we call a pressure meter. And a pressure meter is an existing technology that's been around since the 1950s, used in the civil engineering world to measure in-situ stress and soil strength and the strength of weak, unconsolidated rocks. That tool is basically an instrumented packer. It's just that simple. And it was first devised by a fellow named Louis Menard, and he was using it as a civil engineer to measure the strength of soils on a project out by San Francisco where he couldn't obtain a physically competent soil sample to send to a lab to measure his cohesion and friction angle and these other geomechanical properties. So he basically applied force to the wall of his wellbore and measured how the ground responded to that force. And that, over time, evolved into the modern-day pressure meter, which can exert 5,000 PSI on the wellbore wall, and it applies it in a cylindrical shape, a uniform cylindrical shape. Just think of a packer, like I said, but instrument it so that you can measure the force you're applying and the displacement that you're creating. In the ground, force and displacement translates to stress and strain. And by throwing a lot of math at it and cavity expansion theory, that stress and strain translates to a lot of different rock properties and does show you the in-situ stress condition as well, and the magnitude of the in-situ stress. Whether or not you're seeing or can differentiate maximum from a minimum in-situ stress remains to be seen. I think we depend on the difference in magnitudes. We're hoping to see that with the deep tool, but that is essentially what the pressure meter is all about. In our new tool, which we call the Insight tool, which stands for Institute of Geomechanics Testing, we'll be applying up to 30,000 PSI. So this is meant for, obviously, stronger rocks, but rocks that are buried at depth of up to 5,000 meters. That 30,000 PSI should have the horsepower required to physically impact these rocks and show us how they respond to that force. Because essentially what you're doing with that pressure meter is you're loading and you're unloading the wellbore wall. So you load the wellbore wall with force, and then you watch as you relax that membrane, you watch how the rock responds to that unloading. Is it going to fail in shear failure mode? Is it going to fail in tensile failure mode? Is it not going to fail at all? And you run these loading and unloading cycles in higher and higher steps until you collect the data that you're after. So those are the three main functionalities. The Insight tool does also have a gamma zone mode. So it's just a straight up gamma, just for locating it within the well and that sort of thing. So that is what the tool does.
So your tool is this disruptive technology that's bringing a new look and a new science into the oil field. Could it be used to study wellbore integrity to look at what could be future cementing and casing issues that might lead to, bad cement jobs, bad casing jobs, and ultimately well failure in the future?
100%. You know, the list of applications gets longer and longer with every conversation that I have with various industry experts like yourself. Whether somebody's got a background in geophysics, a background in wellbore completions, or geology overall, there are very, very many facets to this gem that we call oil and gas. And as you're aware, something along the lines of wellbore stability is seen throughout the life cycle of a well. When you're drilling a well, what depth are you going to place your kickoff point at? What orientation do you need to drill that horizontal at? When you complete the well, how do you actually design that completion? Where are you going to see effects based on stress? Where is the stress shadowing going to start creating problems with your orphan wells and parent-child relationships, all that sort of stuff? Not orphan wells, but parent-child. And at the end of the day, once you've put some casing in the ground and you've got cement there holding it in place, are you going to actually trust that thing to stay intact and competent for more than 6 months? And it is certainly factors like is your stress that are going to be needing to be compensated for that and considered for all these different designs. So the applications, they go well beyond oil and gas as well. This is information that's used by mining engineers, that's used by civil engineers. Like I said, the main backbone technology comes from the civil engineering world, and that is the pressure meter, which, you know, we do now call an intelligent packer just so that people visualize it properly. A lot of people think of a pressure gauge when you say pressure meter, but that's not what it is. That's the original name from the civil engineering world. So to keep things kind of a bit more clear, we call it the intelligent packer. But mining engineers, civil engineers, reservoir engineers, drilling and completions, you name it, water floods, CO2 sequestration. Anytime you're dealing with rock strength because you're putting a hole through a layer of rock or you want to do something under a layer of rock, or you need to build on top of a layer of rock, the rock strength and the stress conditions that might affect whatever operations you're planning on putting in place, they're imperative.
5 years ago, you probably didn't see the direction that this tool would go into, and 5 years from now, it could probably change as well. You wrote a little story that says a lot can happen in 5 years. Could you tell us a little bit about that story? A little bit about the story of 5 years of integrity in situ, and, you know, share a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, certainly. I'll try to keep my wits about me because sometimes this story gets the better of me for some reasons that I'm sure will become obvious. But 5 years ago when, it's been 6.5 years now, but when I wrote that article, it had been 5 years. And, you know, what started as an idea, an apparent need in the industry and an opportunity for a technology to be developed and a business to be grown turned into a lot of different things. R&D is very different than a conventional business. You don't have a product that you can start selling and making money with right away. It takes a long time, and when you're developing something from scratch, there's no manual that you can go download off of Google, and there's not a lot of people that can answer a lot of different questions about what you're trying to do because it's never been done before. There's certainly experts at a lot of different things, and you really learn to depend on those experts, and you find ways to find those experts and get their help. But in the beginning, there's a lot of dark corners that you got to go into with your flashlight to try to find some of these answers. So there were a lot of self-teachings, and you know, the school of hard knocks really hammered me to the ground a lot in the early days. And to this day, there's a lot of tough times that you go through as you're not only figuring out how to manage your cash flow and your exposure to grants and dealing with your investors and all the emotions that come with something difficult. The actual work of developing this technology is a whole different set of problems. We've been working on the design originally with a bunch of fellows from the UK who were definitely and still are experts at pressure meter technology. about a year and a half into that process, I was painfully aware, and being a project manager by trade, most recently education-wise, there were a lot of aspects to the overall way the project was going that certainly were not what I was used to and not what I was expecting or wanted. So we brought the technology back from the UK and had it finished off here in Calgary. And there were some things that came along with that that over time were backed out and modified. But coming back from that last trip to the UK, chalk it up to stress, chalk it up to sitting in economy, and I'm 6'3" and 215 pounds. I don't sit in those seats very comfortably for 10 hours at a time. So you get a little run down. You're breathing that recycled air, blah, blah, blah. First world problems, but, you know, this is part of what travel entails. I got a basic sinus infection as a result of it all. And when I came back to Calgary, I had a newborn who was 3 months old, who was son number 3 at the time. And I hit the ground running when the plane landed. I was working, and I did that for the next several weeks. But this sinus infection just seemed to get worse, or whatever it was, right? But I kept working and ignored my body and didn't rest and give myself a break. And before you know it, the one weekend goes by, and I couldn't sleep at all just because I was constantly coughing or in pain or whatever the case was. I slept for 4 hours over the course of the weekend. Okay, this sucks. I'm going to take a Tylenol, and I'm going to go to hockey that morning, and I'm going to go to my meetings and carry on. So I did that. By about 1 in the afternoon, I decided to throw in the towel. I had to go home and try to sleep. I went home, passed out in my suit, and I woke up on Friday.
Wow.
So that was because in the middle of the night.
You missed a couple of days in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a seizure in the middle of the night, and basically whatever I had turned into some kind of a beast that nobody could identify, and it got into my white blood cells and then got into my brain and caused my brain to swell, and I had a fever of 42 degrees Celsius, which is very dangerous. And my body said, okay, enough's enough. We're going to hit the reset button, which means you're going to have a seizure, and we're going to put you in a self-induced coma. So I was in a self-induced coma for those 4 days. And when I woke up, I couldn't see out of my left eye. I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I had no recent memory. Didn't remember my new son, but with 7 days in ICU and a few more days in one of the makeshift beds in the hallway, because the medical system up here is a little taxed at the best of times, I was able to go home, and I was able to walk and talk and get a lot of my memory back. And, you know, my wife was there for it all. And, you know, through the grace of God and some incredible experts here, I was able to get my life back. Couldn't
all the while trying to put a company together.
Yeah. Yeah. Couldn't drive for 6 months. I couldn't work for 2 months, and had no money in the bank. The company was broke. We had our first field trial literally 4 months before this happened, and we had a minor electrical issue, but it stopped the field trial. So we didn't have an invoice. So my investors were really upset. And then this happened, and there was no support to be had from anybody but, you know, my friends and family and my social network. It was quite a thing. But what it taught me, Neil, was what fear is, what real fear is, and what I can handle and what I can't. And I know kind of what I can take, and I know that the fear of failure in this business and in developing this technology and in talking to clients and having difficult conversations with a lot of different people, whether they're investors or whether they're my technical team, none of that stuff fazes me in the least, because I have that perspective of what fear really looks like and feels like. So a lot of blessings that did come of it all, and I'm very fortunate and grateful to God that I am here to move past it and learn from it all and be better at what I do for it all. So, yeah, that was that was the first 5 years in a nutshell.
You've come out of it a much stronger person. Definitely have grown because, you know, in the next 5 years, you have a contract with a giant oil and gas company, maybe the biggest company in the world, Saudi Aramco. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and what the future holds for Integrity Institute?
Yeah, with pleasure. So Saudi Aramco tapped us on the shoulder in late 2017. And we had been at the Global Petroleum Show with the tool. And they had seen us there or heard of us through that. And they said, we heard about this tool, the physical measurements, direct measurements. This is what we want to use for figuring out some of our geomechanical problems. So when can you have it over here? I said, well, you know, this is a prototype and we haven't got this thing working very well yet. And for the pressures and temperatures you're talking about, we can't handle that. So we decided, and, you know, with the way the industry was going as far as activity levels and whatnot, we knew that we needed to expand well beyond Caprock integrity studies in the oil sands in northern Alberta. So we knew that we needed to take this step at some point anyway, but that really helped solidify the thought process that that was where we needed to go. So over the following couple of years, we did a lot of back and forth and negotiating, and there were political issues between our countries, and we addressed those through some various means, and we now operate in the United States as part of that process. You know, we, at the same time, still had to keep the company going and proceed with the existing technology and generate revenues and whatnot. And we did that through a number of different ways, project management and technical support mainly, because the shallow tool just wasn't there and we didn't really have the resources to get it there. So it was tough, but we managed and we survived. And, you know, I went close to 2 years without getting paid. And that's what entrepreneurs do. And this is stuff that you learn as you do it. It's not stuff that you understand until you've been through it, unfortunately. So you do have to learn these things the hard way, which is fine. You get used to it, and it certainly helps you develop a lot of senses and skills that you just otherwise wouldn't get. But as a result of that whole process, we did eventually sign an R&D agreement with Saudi Aramco. We have assembled quite a knowledgeable internal team of experts who have a lot of very direct, specific experience geared towards downhole tools. It's a very different proposition than the first go-around. We've got oil and gas professionals who have done nothing but work on oil and gas technology their entire careers, everything from downhole completion systems and packer designs, perforating systems, MWD equipment, geophysical logging tools, the firmware involved in it all. Altogether, right now, we have probably 140 years of R&D experience in our shop. So we're about 6 months away from having this new tool finished, the prototype that is, and ground-proofed here in Alberta in some deep shales. And then we'll be taking it over to Saudi Arabia to do the same with them. The new tool will be capable of operating at temperatures of, I think it's around 375 degrees Fahrenheit, hydrostatic pressure, collapse pressure of 20,000 PSI. So that's going to put 95% of the world's exploration projects within reach of this new technology.
So where you had strife, you found opportunity. Where you had problems, you found solutions. With all the creative things that have happened in your life, you've come up with this opportunity not only for yourself, but for the geology world, solving the questions that we have of what we cannot see. Is one of the greatest questions and hardest answers in studying rocks. Tools like what you've developed are one of the few ways for all of us to see what's going on down there and to figure out geologic questions. What's your favorite part about running, you know, the Integrity Institute tool? And what's your favorite question that you like to answer when, you know, working with this science?
That's a good question. I think the favorite part for me, I really enjoy the physical side of operating equipment in the field, hooking things up to this gigantic rig that in itself is a technological marvel, and sticking this thing hundreds, if not thousands of meters into the ground and talking to it and seeing in real time what it's seeing is truly amazing and rewarding. And, you know, as I've said, we've done that to an extent with that shallow tool, and we'll be doing that within the next 6 months here with that deep tool. So I'm very excited for that on a different level as far as those pressures and temperatures go. But the physical process of what you're doing is really quite satisfying, thinking of stuff in this giant chunk of steel full of sensors and electronics and dealing with the temperatures and the pressures that are down there and talking to it and having it actually respond is very fun. And it's very nerve-wracking because you don't know what is going to happen necessarily in every case. Don't know if it's going to work, if it's going to send you usable data. But when it does, it's very exciting. Yeah, so when it comes to the data itself, I think the in-situ stress condition, you know, we can use a mini-frac to see average in-situ stress, but the way we're going about it is very intriguing as far as applying that load to the wallbore wall and then watching it unload is a very interesting process when you think about what's happening, how that pore pressure is moving beyond the wallbore and how you're seeing the effective versus total pressures and stresses. And really, handing that data set to an expert, the people that get really into the weeds with this type of information, they're all PhDs. They're all brilliant in their fields, and I love working with them. They're all very kind people. They're all very professional, and they know their stuff, and all they do is teach. They teach if you're willing to learn, and if you're able to close your yapper and listen. These people have all the knowledge you can ever imagine, and the geomechanics world is quite a black box to a lot of us, and I'm no different. I obviously have enough information that I'm dangerous, but I trust the experts to really come up with these numbers and reports. So handing that data off and seeing what they can do with it is very, very rewarding.
And wrapping up, Corey, I want to thank you for joining me. You know, you're a survivor, you're an entrepreneur, you've created opportunity for geologists, geomechanics, geophysicists, and for, you know, the oil and gas industry and beyond, civil engineering, soil mechanics, and others to be able to manage and direct data in the subsurface to build upon oil and gas well stability, foundations, equipment, you know, things of that nature in civil engineering. Without people like you looking into the future and leading into new technology, we won't have, you know, a better world in front of us. And Integrity In Situ seems like you're making leaps and bounds forward how to analyze and interpret, whether it be soil, rock, sediment, unconsolidated sediment, and everything in between, which to me is a lot of fun and a really big deal.
Well, I appreciate the kind words and your support, Neil. It's always fantastic to get insight from folks like yourselves, the ones that really know what's happening and the end users of this information. So I appreciate that. And it's that type of stuff that keeps us going because we need it, and I really appreciate it. So thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to join you today.
And I want to thank all of you for listening. This wraps up another Geology Vlog podcast. Tune in, turn on, drop out, and we'll catch you on the flip side.